Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Elise H. from the South College Group in Newark, Delaware.
I'm Elise. I'm an alcoholic. There's a lot of you. Forgive me. I get nervous when I speak. So I have a home group, and that is South College Speakers Group in Newark, Delaware. I live in Chester County, Pennsylvania. I have a sponsor, and I also sponsor women. I have the privilege to do that today. I'd like to thank Dave for asking me to speak, and also to the girls who rode up here with me tonight. All right, so I will try to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I grew up in a family where things were, I guess I'd call it a normal family. There was a lot of love. I had two parents. I hear a lot of speakers from the podium say that, they had broken homes, and I didn't have that. Our parents were always there for us. I had a sister. And I have a lot of happy memories as a child. I don't remember feeling different. I also hear a lot of speakers talk about feeling different. That came later on for me. And as a child, I didn't feel different. I had a very happy childhood. I have very happy memories. My father is an alcoholic. I don't have bad memories of that as a child. His disease progressed later on. So I guess my story really starts in my early teen years. I have an aunt who's from Europe, and it was acceptable at holidays to have a glass of wine when I was like 8, 9. I don't really know when I picked up my first drink. I know that probably around that time, maybe a little bit later, I would, at those holidays, I would have the glass of wine at dinner, and I would also sneak wine later on. As a child, I do remember my parents having a lot of parties, a lot of wild parties, and I always... From an early age, I guess, I kind of looked at alcohol as something that was very fun. There was a lot of laughter when everyone was around. There was a lot of loud music, and it looked like fun. And I was usually sent to bed early when the house was full. I know now that my parents spent a lot of time with a lot of alcoholics, and so I saw alcoholics drinking from a young age, and I thought that that's what normal drinking was. So I have a sister who's older than me. She's 6 years older than me, and she kind of paved the road for me. But she, probably around the time she was 16, started to get into drugs and alcohol, and somehow I was able to convince her to give me alcohol as well. And she remembers, she tells me now, she remembers like feeling really bad about me getting drunk when I was like 10, maybe 11. I don't remember that. My first real memory of getting intoxicated, I was 14, and I was with a girlfriend, and we went and hung out with guys I didn't know. She knew them. We lied about our age. And I drank a bottle of Jägermeister with one of the guys. I blacked out, and I peed myself. And I woke up in the morning. I hadn't gone home. I was supposed to go home. And I did the walk of shame up my driveway, having peed myself. And my mom was waiting at the front door for me. She was not very happy. And I went upstairs and passed out. I didn't even care to talk to her about it. I went straight to bed. I was very sick. I didn't know at the time, but while I was passed out that night, I was sexually assaulted. And when I realized that, I was 14. It was summer break, and I was about to start back to high school. And I didn't, when I found that out, I didn't know how to handle that, and I didn't want to tell anyone, and so I didn't. And I let that eat at me for a long time, and I used that as an excuse for a long time. At that point, my drinking really took off at 14 years old. Shortly thereafter, I began to, you know, it really, my story, it's a lot about alcohol, but if you had anything that would take me out of myself, that was fine too, as long as it did the job. I'll try to keep it to alcohol. So at that point, you know, and I talk about the sexual assault because I only say it in hopes that I can help someone. I know that there are a lot of women in this program who go through that. And that is, I know today that's not the reason that I became an alcoholic, especially because like 75% of my family is alcoholic. It was probably predetermined that I was going to be an alcoholic. So I just want to say that. So at that point, I started hanging out with people who were a lot older than me and, like, of age, could get alcohol. And every weekend it was, you know, where are we going? What are we doing? I grew up in the country, so it was a lot of bonfires, a lot of running from the cops, a lot of dirt roads and, you know, what are we going to do? And there was a lot of, I didn't start driving until I was a little bit older, so, I was always very strict about, I'm not going to drink and drive, but I had no problem getting in the car with someone else who was intoxicated. That didn't matter to me. I think I was more fearful of getting arrested than getting hurt or hurting someone else. So I'm struggling in school at this point, and around 16, I'm using drugs. I'm drinking all the time. I'm drinking on school nights. I'm drinking on weekends. It doesn't matter. I'm going to school hungover. And I guess the school nurse caught on to me that I would be hungover, and I would come lay down in the nurse's office and miss classes. And I must have reeked. The principal came in one day while I was laying down and told me that the state police were on the way and that I needed to take a breathalyzer test. And I did, and I blew a .06 in the morning after. And so cops got there, and the cops took a really long time getting there. And when the officer got there, he gave me a breathalyzer test, and I blew a .00. I was suspended from school, and the school really was not happy about having me there. I was a pain. I got into a lot of trouble in school. I was failing out of, you know, college prep classes, and I was a train wreck. And most of the time, I wasn't going to school. I was either too sick or I was crawling out of my skin. I didn't know how to talk to people. I didn't know how to, I didn't know at this point how to be me without alcohol or drugs. So I was suspended from school. And at this point, my parents did everything they could to help me through this. And they were, my mom, my poor mother, she was in school all the time, you know, because as an alcoholic, I'm a victim of, I used to be a victim of everything that other people had done. So somehow I'd manipulate my mother into believing that. And she would be at school, you know, standing up for me. And she did everything she could to help me along this journey. She forced me to go to an AA meeting after I was suspended from school. She tried to get me into a rehab. And I wouldn't go. I would not comply. So I guess at this point I'm probably in therapy. I ended up going back to public school. And it was still painful. I still wasn't going to school. I think my sophomore year, I missed like 60-some days of school. I missed a lot of school. And I was full of fear. I was full of fear, especially when it came to other human beings. And I ended up leaving that school, and I went to an alternative school. And I know today that pretty much everyone there also suffers from a spiritual malady. There were about 60 students there, and at least 10 of them have passed away since we graduated of this disease, be it suicide. There was one guy who was beaten to death by police officers in Philadelphia. We were all a train wreck, and we were in good company. Somehow, through going to that alternative school, I did end up graduating high school. When I was 16, the summer that I was going into my junior year, I went on a vacation with a girlfriend. We went to Key West, Florida. A friend of ours was doing an internship in Key West. And I had a very similar experience there that I did when I was 14. I was assaulted again. This time was a little bit different. It was more of an attack, I guess. And I decided to press charges. And I went to the hospital. And I came home, and I had this court case looming over me and continuances every month. And I was just in such a dark place. I was severely depressed. I was drinking all the time. At this point, I was probably becoming a daily drinker. So, anyway, I end up getting through that that case, and I end up also graduating high school somehow by the skin of my teeth. And I actually did apply to college, and no colleges wanted me. Surprise. I still had an ego. Still thought that somehow a college would want me, even though I had failed out of a lot of classes. I had done summer school, was suspended from school multiple times. So I decided that I was going to go travel. And I know today that I have been in the past a big fan of the geographic solution. You guys will get to hear about that. But I thought that going somewhere else would make me okay. So I graduate high school, and I go to France and Spain with friends of mine and had a great time, come back. And I'm like, that's it. That's all I want to do. I want to travel. So I save my money all summer, and I come to my mom, and I say, I'm going to Costa Rica alone and Panama. And she's like, no, you're not. And she's like, find somebody to go with you. I said, okay. So I find a young man to go with me. He's a friend of mine. He was perfect. He was codependent. He, I think, wanted to be involved with me romantically, and I had no interest, but I knew I'd be safe. So that was perfect. So we go to Central America together. I have never spoke, well, until a few weeks ago, I had never spoken to him again since we came back. It was a mess. I was drunk the entire time that I was there. I did things like, we decided to go to Panama, and I did things like not come home for the night on this like crazy island in Panama. And I came back to the hostel in the morning, and the people that I was with were packing their things. And I'm like, you guys weren't going to leave without me, were you? And they were. They were very upset with me. And so at that point, I was like, well, F you guys. So I go back to Costa Rica on my own. And, you know, all through my drinking, I was putting myself in really bad situations. And I did that. You know, I'm in Central America, and I'm, like, disappearing for the night with random strangers that I don't know. And that was okay with me at the time. So I come back from Central America. I got really, really sick while I was there. I got dengue fever. And so the ending of my trip was a little more calm just because I couldn't keep anything down anyway. I fly home, and I come home to my parents' house. All my girlfriends are at my parents' house. And I'm like, wow, everyone's really excited to see me. And I go to sit down, and I'll never forget it. I was, like, mid-sitting down, and my mom says to me, we have to talk to you. And I said, okay. And she said, Ritter. And I said, what? She said, and Ritter was my best friend. And Ritter also suffered from this disease. All of my friends did. Kind of goes without saying. And she said, Ritter shot himself while you were gone. And I said, but he's okay, right? She said, no, he's dead. And the services had happened while I was in Central America. No one wanted to tell me. They didn't know how I was going to react. And I kind of retreated into a very dark place after that. And I was working at a restaurant and just kind of threw myself into that and continued to save money. Didn't know what I was going to do, but I knew I wanted to continue to travel. I knew that when I traveled, I could drink the way I wanted to, drug the way I wanted to, use men the way I wanted to, and not feel bad about it because nobody knew me. And I could just up and leave the next day. So it was kind of the perfect situation for the good alcoholic that I was. And so I met a guy and was seeing him. He was from Canada and was going back to Canada. And he had told me that I should go to massage school. So 2 weeks later, I'm on a plane to Portugal to go to massage school because Portugal is the perfect place for this alcoholic. And I'm 18, 19. I think I turned 19 while I was there. And I spend 3 months in massage school in Portugal. I drank my way through Europe, and I found a good alcoholic boyfriend while I was there. And I struggled through the program. It was a highly intensive program, and I couldn't keep up with it the way I was drinking. I was sick a lot of mornings. A lot of mornings I didn't come to class. And, you know, I had taken out a loan for like $8,000 to go to school, and I didn't care. And to me, it was like, oh, Portugal, yoga, ocean, I like it. So one of my teachers, Judith, sits me down one day, and she says to me, you're not going to graduate this program. You're an absolute mess. You're not progressing, and I'd like you to go to AA. And I said, I'll try harder, but I'm not going to AA. And she, bless her heart, tried so hard to be there for me. And originally, I had a roommate. I had two roommates while I was there. My first roommate spent a week living with me and said, I'm moving out. I can't live with you. And I had a big resentment against her for a long time, and I have since then been able to make an amends to her. And we speak pretty frequently. She's a pretty amazing woman. So, you know, at this point, I'm harming everyone who comes into contact with me. And my teacher at massage school, she really wanted to help me. So when my roommate wanted to move out, I went to my teacher and spilled the beans because I thought it would look better if I came to her and told her I'm an alcoholic. And this entire time that I'm drinking, from the first time I pick up a drink and black out and pee myself to now, I know that something isn't right. I know that I'm an alcoholic, but I still have ideas and I'm not willing to stop. I'm not ready to stop. I still needed more pain out there. So I do somehow get through this program. And I come home from Europe. I leave the boyfriend in Europe, and he was too old for me anyway. And I come home, and now my alcoholic brain is planning what the next adventure is going to be. And I don't think that there is any better place for an alcoholic than to go to the California wine country and learn how to make wine. So that's what I decided to do. And at this point, I'm really, for some reason, when I came home from Europe, I'm not sure what it was about, but that entire summer, I don't remember getting out of control at all. I guess I still had the power of choice. I was able to, my rule was, I'll have two drinks and I'm done. And I stuck to that, but it was miserable because that's not the way I wanted to drink. I wanted to drink to black out. I wanted to drink to take me out of me. So I find an internship in Napa Valley, and I go to Napa Valley to a winery. I find a family on Craigslist, and that I'm going to live with them. I'm going to bike to work every day. I'm going to work in the winery, and I'm going to have a good time. I'm not even 21 yet. And I show up at the house. It's like an $8 million home. I'm renting a room there, and turns out they have cocktail hour on the terrace every night, and you can see San Francisco from the terrace. And they don't care that I'm not 21. So it's like the perfect place for me. They're both alcoholics. And I did work very hard while I was there. I had a lot of fun while I was there as well. You know, it's when I look back on my addiction, there were a lot of fun times. I was extremely happy while I was in California. So things went pretty successfully in California. And there was one night that the owners of the house had gone away, and I decided that they had told me that I'm not allowed to have anyone in the house, and I decided that was a good night to bring someone home. And that didn't go over so well, and I got caught. So I end up falling in love with a man in California, and I come home after the internship is over, and I stay in touch with him, and I decide that I'm going to move back to California. Meanwhile, he's like trying to work things out with his wife. And but he was good and codependent too, so he was another perfect victim. So I moved back to California, and I kept telling myself, I'm not moving back for him. I'm moving back. And I got extremely close with the winemaker of the company that I was working for, and she's still a very dear friend of mine. So I moved back to California, and it's like on. I had a successful trip the first time to California. This time it was like, I think my first night there, her and I drank like half a bottle of gin together, and it was bad. So I found like the perfect situation. I'm like taking care of some guy's horses 2 days a week and living in a studio on his property for free. And I'm working for a company that I get a company truck, a company phone, a company gas card, and I don't have to, no one knows where I am. I have to go check 50 vineyards every week for pests and disease. And so I was supposed to be out there 8 hours a day, and I was maybe out there 2 hours a day if I went out at all. And then I was off to the bar. I'm still not 21. All of my friends in California believe I'm like 23. I'm living a lie. And I knew what bars I could drink at. I knew which ones carded or would card me. And I got away with it for a long time. So I get to a point where every day at 2 o'clock, I'm like, okay, I'm done working. I'm going to the bar. I'm like 20 years old, and I'm a raging drunk. And so I'm still involved with this man, and at this point, we're like, we're going to be friends. No, we're just going to sleep together. No, we're going to have a relationship. No, he's going to work things out with his wife. Really healthy relationship. And I decide that I'm going to come home and get back on my feet. I'm having financial issues because I'm spending all of my money on alcohol and really expensive meals. And, you know, I'm living rent-free and I can't get by. So I decided I'm going to come home, get back on my feet. I'm going to move back to California, and this guy and I are going to live happily ever after. And I come home, and I don't know if he did this intentionally, but shortly after I got home, he tells me that he's not going to live with me and that he does not want to live with me. And can't blame him. So I get a job here in Pennsylvania. And, you know, again, it was that geographic solution. I was going to come home and I don't know. I was going to be different because I was living in a different place. But wherever I go, I find me. So I come home from California. I get a good job. I'm here. He and I are still involved. He's flying out every month to see me. I'm flying out there. And still extremely dysfunctional. He comes out to see me, you know, when he's got like 2 days to see me. He works very hard. He's actually a winemaker and not an alcoholic. I don't know too many of those. But he comes out to see me, and I'm like, let's go to the bar. And so we have a few drinks, and he's like, and at this point I've turned 21. He's like, okay, it's time to go home. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm just getting started. And I would get, like, blacked out drunk. So here this man flies all the way across the country to see me, and I don't even, like, remember the time we spent together. And somehow he's still he was getting something. I don't know. Because he stuck by me for a while. And at this point, he's talking to me about my alcoholism, and he's asking me to get help, and I don't want to hear it. And he's saying, you know, when we're out, it's time to stop. And I'm angry, and like, you can go home. I'm staying here. So we decide that he's going to move to Pennsylvania and sell his winery. And we're going to go travel the world together. We're going to go travel in Europe together for a year. And I'm sure that was my idea, not his. And a week before he, maybe it wasn't a week, I think it was a few days before he was supposed to come because his car was packed. I'm sharing with him that I'm cheating on him with men, all, you know, multiple men. And his car's packed, and I call him, and I'm like, this is wrong. You can't come. You can't come. You can't sell your winery. That's ridiculous. And he's like, okay, well, then why don't you move to California? And I'm like, okay, I'll move back to California. So I make arrangements, and 4 months later, I'm on a plane to California. I've shipped all of my things to California. And he's going to rent a house, he's going to buy me a car, and he's going to put me through college. Perfect solution for me. So I show up in California, and he's different. He is sobbing, and he tells me that he was suicidal the night before. And, you know, it's amazing how we impact the people that we love. And that he needs to go to a psychiatric hospital and that I need to go stay with friends. And I'm like, holy shit, what is going on? This is not what I planned. And so he goes and he stays in a hospital and he comes out. And I cheat on him while he's in the hospital. And he gets out and he breaks up with me. Shocker. And he tells me that this isn't right and that he made a big mistake by having me move to California. And I am a mess. I thought this man was my solution. I thought things were going to be better when I was with him, when I was in California, when I got my degree, when I whatever. And I know that's gone now. And I beg him. I beg him to stay with me. I beg him to give it a chance. And he won't. He won't give it a chance. Puts me on a plane home, Valentine's Day of 2009. I thought I was broken because I am also codependent, and I did not know how to live without this man. I did not know how to live without the plans of this man because we were always living in the future. And I end up on my parents' couch, and I end up there for a few months. And I find a job, and I find a job where I'm making excessive amounts of money, and I'm blowing all of that money on food, really expensive food, really expensive restaurants, and top shelf alcohol. I think that because I'm drinking top shelf alcohol, I'm not an alcoholic. I think that I'm functioning. And within 6 months, I am completely, I guess it was less than 6 months, 5 months, I'm done. I'm just done. Towards the end, I had once again lost the power of choice. I wasn't going to work anymore because I was too sick. I worked an hour from my house, and usually in the mornings I was too drunk to drive to work. So I wake up on July 9th, and I don't know what was different that morning, because every morning for the previous 5 months I had woken up and promised myself I was not going to do this again. I was not going to wake up next to a stranger again. I was not going to be sick again. I was not going to be too drunk to drive to work. And by 5-6 o'clock that night, I was at it again. I'm blacking out all the time. Every time I pick up a drink at this point, I'm blacking out. And so I wake up July 9th, I woke up July 8th, and I'm like, I'm done. I'm done this time. And I had said that every other morning for the past 5 months. And I go, I make a phone call to my insurance company and find out where I can go to treatment. I had been to AA meetings off and on at this point, and I knew I needed to be removed from my situation to get sober. And I call my insurance company, and they tell me where I can go to treatment. I call the treatment facility. My dad is sober at this point. He's also a member. I call my dad after I called the treatment center, and he's like, I'll be there. I'll be right there. He shows up at my house. He takes the day off. And they don't have a bed at the treatment center that I'm supposed to go to, but they'll call me in the morning. And they also tell me on the phone to not stop drinking. So that was an excuse. You know, that was permission to do what I did the night before. So I went out that night, blacked out, went to treatment in the morning, and went to the Malvern Institute. I spent 31 days there. You know, I did what was asked of me while I was there. And at this point, I was scared to come out of treatment. I was scared that I was going to drink again. And I moved back into my apartment, and I invited a heroin addict of 18 years to live with me, because I don't want to do this alone. And so he comes and he lives with me in my second bedroom. And we fought and went head to head, and he wasn't paying rent, and I was on food stamps. I had gone from like a six-figure job to food stamps within a month and a half. And because I didn't put any money away. So I end up kicking him out. I get a sponsor. I get a home group. And at this point, I'm really like, I'm on a pink cloud. And I'm staying sober on that. My sponsor had me sit down and do some step work. I was asking to move forward with my steps. And she was telling me no, that it was too fast. And so once again, I decide I'm going to try the geographic solution. And in January of 2010, there is an earthquake in Haiti. And I am going to go save Haiti. So I get on a plane to Haiti. And I go over my spring break. At this point, I'm also enrolled in school again, college. And I go to Haiti. I spend 10 days there. My first day there is everyone's day off. Get one day off a week. And I'm volunteering with an organization. There's like 80 people there. It seemed like every single one of them was an alcoholic. And so the day off, and I go to the bar with all of these people. And I'm like, no, I'm fine. Everybody's offering me drinks. No, I'm fine. And somebody And at this point, I am not happy in sobriety. I am crawling out of my skin. I don't know how to talk to people again. I'm fearful of people. And a drink starts to look really good. Nobody there knows who I am. Nobody there knows that I'm a recovering alcoholic. And I don't have the full solution. And so this guy comes up to me, starts talking to me. Can I buy you a drink? Sure. He walks away, and I pray. And I knew that if he came back with that drink, I was going to drink. And he disappears for a while, and I don't see him. And I don't even know what I said to God. I just said, please don't let me drink. And he comes back, and his hands are empty. And he turns to me, and he says, there's someone on the street starving, and I decided to spend the rest of my money on food for them instead of drinks for us. And that was a God moment. That was my first day in Haiti. And I after that happened, I didn't have a desire to drink the rest of the time I was there. And I also told him that night that I'm a recovering alcoholic and that I've been sober for, like, I don't know, maybe 7 months at this point. And he ends up having a brother who's in the program and is extremely supportive, although he himself is an alcoholic, I'm sure. But I, wherever I go, I find other alcoholics to be with. I love other alcoholics, active or not. So I get through that, and then I come home, and, you know, I'm still not really going through my steps with my sponsor. And I decide I'm going to go spend my summer in Haiti because I guess once wasn't enough. So I am, and, you know, again, at this point, I'm looking for a geographic solution. too. So I leave for Haiti after, I think, like 3 days after I got out of school. And I get there, so it was May. I get there, and I'm sober somehow. I want a drink. I'm scared of people. And there's like 120 people at base at this point. I'm living with 120 people. We take bucket showers and flush the toilets with buckets. And everybody drinks at night. Everybody. And, like, gets wasted. And it looks good to me. Well, I end up getting very sick while I'm in Haiti. I have a tendency to do that when I'm in the developing world. I get very ill and end up, I've taken a hospital tour of the developing world. So I end up in a tent hospital in Haiti and spend a couple days there. They just give me meds for, they don't know what I have. So I end up, and I was miserable. I was completely miserable at this point. Nobody came to check on me. And, again, my alcoholic thinking tells me that I'm so important that everybody from base, you know, all 120 of them should be coming to visit me at the hospital to see how I am. And, you know, not busy helping the community that they came to help. And so I got very resentful. And within 3 weeks of being in Haiti, I'm like, F this, I'm going home. So I couldn't get a flight out. Somebody had actually bought me my flight to Haiti, and he said to me, he's like, I can't get you a flight immediately. Like, you've got to give it a couple weeks. So I'm like, okay, how many weeks? He's like, two. I'm like, okay, book my flight for 2 weeks. So I come home, and before I left, I had met a young woman who had just come into the rooms, and she has been emailing me while I'm away, and she's obviously happy, and she's telling me about a group that I should go to. So I come to the speaker meeting with her, and I'm like, wow, these people are happy, and they have something. I heard something in the speakers I had never heard in speakers in my area. My area, it's a lot of a lot of, like, 90 and 90 and, you know, not writing a fourth step till you have a year sober or, like, a step a year, which, if you're as sick as I was, then I needed relief. I was on my way out of these rooms because being sober was becoming too painful. So I end up going to the speaker group, and I'm not talking, I'm not introducing myself to people because I'm even terrified of people in AA at this point. And I hear a speaker one night, and he talks about being miserable in this program for 9 years, and I'm completely miserable, and I'm like, oh, my God, that's going to be me. And I probably would have drank before 9 years, but I knew what he was talking about, and he talked about the fact that there is a way to recover from this disease, and that life doesn't have to be painful sober, and that we don't have to white knuckle it. And there was one girl I knew down there, and I went up to her, and I'm like, that's going to be me. And she's like, yeah. She's like, you're in pain. I said, yeah. And I said, can you help me find somebody to take me through my steps the way you guys do it? And she said, well, I can do it. And I turned to her, and I was like, you have less time than me. And she turns to me, and she goes, I've got the 12 steps, and you don't. So I'm like, okay, since I'm fearful of everyone else, you will do. So I love you, Steph. So she sits down with me immediately. And, you know, the one thing she said to me, she said, if you're in pain, don't sit in it because you're going to drink again. She sits down with me immediately and starts to take me through my steps. We do 1, 2, and 3 at a Dunkin' Donuts. She gives me direction for 4. I write a 4th step. My 4th step, I was given direction to write a 4th step as a resentments list, fears list, and sex inventory. And so we sit down to do my 5th step. And my 5th step, I think, took a little longer than she probably expected. I had a lot of resentments, and I also had quite the sex inventory. So it was a 2-part thing. It took probably about 8 hours to do my 5th step, but I experienced something, you know, and she had all the time in the world for that. And I don't really remember doing 6 and 7. I remember feeling like I wasn't doing it thoroughly enough, but having seen my character defects, I had written a 4th step previously, but I did not experience what and I had done a 5th step previously, but I didn't experience what I experienced when I sat down with this woman. The first time I did a 5th step with someone, she looked at my inventory and she turned to me and she said, okay, so you're dishonest, you're selfish, and, you know, and I was like, what? What the hell are you talking about? Like, I'm not selfish, I'm not dishonest. But we went through every single thing that was on that inventory, one for one, and we talked about what my role was in each one of those things. And I experienced something there. I really felt like a jackass afterwards. I you know, a lot of people talk about getting relief immediately after doing a 5th step. I was like, holy shit, I'm a horrible person. And thank God we have 6 and 7, because that's what 6 and 7 are for, because it's like, wow, I'm just not a good person, and what do I do with this? And I go to God with this. So I wrote an 8th step list and went out to do my 9th step to make amends. I was really excited about making amends. I was really excited about making amends to that poor man in California. And it didn't, you know, at this point, I was definitely inviting God into this, and I think that's why I was so comfortable with making amends. It was like, okay, whatever he says, I need to hear. So I got some amends out of the way, and then I went to him. And he said to me, you know, I really don't have a lot to say to you other than the fact, you know, I said, is there anything I've done that I'm unaware of? And he said, yeah. And he said, you made me suicidal. He said, I almost killed myself because of you. And I listened. And I called my sponsor afterwards, and I was like, I don't think I made him suicidal. And she's like, well, it doesn't have to be your truth, but it's his, and you listen to it. And he called me a few weeks later, and he asked me not to contact him, and that was part of my living amends to him. I didn't do it perfectly. There may have been a few text messages in there, but I did it to the best of my ability. I really did try. you know, I've made amends, and amends crop up. I make amends when I need to. And let's see, 10, 11, and 12. I guess went over 10 and 11 at the same time. I was very fearful of meditation. I was very scared of my mind and what the things my mind told me. So it really took me a long time to get into meditation. Recently, I've had some experiences that I've been in a lot of pain, and I needed to sit with God. I needed to hear God instead of just asking God. I really needed to listen. And that pain has definitely helped me to connect my meditation. You know, I think as alcoholics, prayer comes easily for us because we're always asking for something, or at least I was. And then I also had a lot of fear about working with others. Even though I had experienced something through these 12 steps in here, I didn't feel, and sometimes I still feel like this, but I didn't feel like I had enough of a solution. Like I needed more before I could get to somebody else. But I had been through these 12 steps. I had had a spiritual experience, and I try to practice these principles in all my affairs. And my sponsor was leaving for Brazil, so she gave me a sponsee. And I was terrified. I was so scared. But her sponsee hadn't been through all 12, and she wanted me to take her through the rest of the steps. And it was fine. It was totally fine. And after that, it was like, yeah, I like this. Like, I like sponsoring women. And I went out and continued to try to find women, and I still do. I've taken women through their steps. I have seen a lot of those women go out. I have seen some of them stick around for a while. Unfortunately, a lot of alcoholics do go out and they don't stay. And, you know, working with others is a great privilege. I try not to let it feed my ego. I try to stay humble and I try to ask God to sponsor these women because I'm just another alcoholic. And left to my own devices, I'll take you down with me too. So I've recently had an experience that I think is important to talk about. I started to not feel good in my sobriety again, and I was working with others. I was praying and meditating, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. I asked my sponsor to take me through the steps again. I wrote inventory, and I realized some things through that inventory, and there were only three names on that resentment list. And, you know, if I'm 10th stepping thoroughly, hopefully I'm getting some of these things out of the way. And through writing those three names and the three resentments, or, you know, however many resentments were associated, there weren't many, I realized that I was making a lot of decisions based on self-will, and I was not inviting God into everything. I was inviting God into painful situations and decisions where I faced indecision, but not decisions like, where am I going to transfer to school? Do I want to be in school? And I realized that school is an ego-feeding thing for me, and that I was running on ego and self-will again. And, you know, I'm just kind of coming out of that, and I paid a lot of spiritual consequences for that. I had no idea that I was doing it. I had no idea that I was, like, getting as sick as I was until I was, like, when I went over that inventory, I was like, wow, how did I get so sick so quick? But, you know, it comes back so fast. It comes back so fast. So, I'm doing my best now to invite God into all of my decisions. I made some poor choices with men and did not invite God into those decisions. I left that to my own choices, my own will. And I'm doing my best to invite God into everything that I'm doing now, choices about school, the happy decisions, you know, the good decisions, as much as the painful decisions or the painful experiences that I've had. So, you know, and I was scared at that point. I was very fearful that I was going to drink, and I was not happy, and I kept saying, you know, to other people in this program. And the other thing that definitely happened for me was I got to know a lot more people because I was reaching out for help. Because of that pain I experienced, I'm a lot closer with a lot more alcoholics now. And that's a beautiful thing. I really stepped up my meditation. Like, that fear I had about meditation, like, when I got in pain again, I was sitting in meditation for a half hour versus the, like, 2 minutes that I was like, oh, quick, before school, I can give God 2 minutes. And it's benefited me. But at the time when I was feeling that pain, I was like, when is this going to go away? Like, I'm doing everything I'm supposed to. I'm praying. I'm meditating. I'm 10th stepping. And I'm working with others. Like, and everyone just kept saying to me, keep putting one foot in front of the other. Keep doing what you know how to do best. You know, just keep doing it. And I felt like because I was feeling this way, I wasn't working my program. But in reality, I was working my program. You know, the Big Book never promises that we're not going to have painful experiences. And we do. And you know, I've witnessed some friends have some extremely painful experiences recently. And we do go through painful experiences in life. That's just life. But it's what we do about it, you know, and how we handle it. And do we continue to work this program? And, you know, I did that to the best of my ability, even though it didn't feel good. And I stayed sober through it, and I'm still working with others, and I'm feeling much better. God has helped me with that. But that I'm really grateful for that painful experience that I just had, because my meditation's better. I've got better relationships with other members. And I feel a lot more honest as well. It was a humbling experience, which is always a great thing for an alcoholic. So thanks for having me up to speak.